So this evening, we come to the conclusion of the third chapter, The Eternal and the Individual, in the Life Divine, second book. The music that we just listened to was recorded on the 13th of March in 1963. So in previous pages, we have seen that Sri Aurobindo has been discussing the limits of language and logic and asserting that the cosmos and the individual cannot be mere impositions upon Brahman, but in fact inhere in the absolute. They are part of it. When we say neti neti, it is not this, it is not that, that rings true. But one might also say iti iti, it is this, it is that. The Upanishads are replete, even the Brihadaranyaka, with many examples of how Brahman is described as being this and being that. All things are part of that oneness. So, to follow that theme, the opposites which we see in logic as being mutually contradictory coexist within the absolute. The truth of being is at once an essence, a transcendence, but is also a truth in universal manifestation, is also a truth within the individual who exists within that universal manifestation. All these are poises of divine being. So contradictions, he says, cannot restrict the full view of what is the absolute. We cannot approach it with the logic of the mind. We have to arrive at that which reconciles all distinctions and contradictions. What is beyond them all are absorbed into that, exist within that. So he says the universe and the individual are true and eternal powers of an essential being. That essence is the truth of things, and the eternal is present in the uncoiling of evolution in time. So we're not compelled at the height of spiritual philosophy to insist that all be dissolved into an eternity, erasing all becoming. So he's been in the midst of three great arguments here. One, what is the gulf between the absolute and all relativities? What is the nature of this law of contradictions? And of course, the third one, which we'll deal with in a few pages, it is eternity that generates the universe, not time. Time itself is a manifestation of eternity and coexistent with the universe. So that's the lay of where we are. I think we can resume with his argument now. In our practical dealings with life, we have to arrive at the same truth. For certain practical ends, we have to say that a thing is good or bad, beautiful or ugly, just or unjust, and act upon that statement. But if we limit ourselves by it, we do not get at real knowledge. The law of contradictions here is only valid insofar as two different and opposite statements cannot be true of the same thing at the same time, in the same field, in the same respect, from the same point of view, and for the same practical purpose. So his argument again. Restored fullness sees the transcendent in the universe and the individual. And the observation that he's just made applies to the manifest divided world. We have to have a fuller view. We can't see things simply from the surface. And now he gives an instance of what he means. A great war, destruction, or violent all-upheaving revolution, for example, may present itself to us as an evil, a virulent and catastrophic disorder. And it is so in certain respects, results, ways of looking at it. but from others it may be a great good, since it rapidly clears the field for a new good or a more satisfying order. No man is simply good or simply bad. Every man is a mixture of contraries. Even when we find these contraries, often inextricably mixed up in a single feeling, a single action. All kinds of conflicting qualities, powers, values meet together and run into each other to make up our action, life, nature. We can only understand entirely if we get to some sense of the absolute and yet look at its workings in all the relativities which are being manifested. Look not only at each by itself, but each in relation to all and to that which exceeds and reconciles them all. So we must see all relativities contextualized and contained within the absolute to understand. In fact, we can only know by getting to the divine view and purpose in things, and not merely looking at our own, though our own limited human view and momentary purpose have their validity in the cadre of the all. For behind all relativities, there is this absolute which gives them their being and their justification. No particular act or arrangement in the world is by itself absolute justice, but there is behind all acts and arrangements something absolute which we call justice, which expresses itself through their relativities and which we would realize if our view and knowledge were comprehensive instead of being as they are, partial, superficial, limited to a few ostensible facts and appearances. The term ostensible meaning seeming, you know, to show. Hence the term ostentatious, to show, to seem. So too, there is an absolute good and an absolute beauty, but we can only get a glimpse of it if we embrace all things impartially and get beyond their appearances to some sense of that which, between them, all and each are, by their complex terms, trying to state and work out, not an indeterminate, for the indeterminate being only the original stuff, or perhaps the packed condition of determinations, would explain by itself nothing at all but the absolute. So he's given a number of things here where we can find, if we have a penetrating gaze, an absolute behind the relativities, even when we come to looking at the indeterminate. You might say this is a return to his earliest argument about the nature of being, that from non-being comes being. But non-being doesn't mean non-existence. It means that which cannot be conscribed, confined within the state of positive being. It eludes even that definition of itself. To continue. We can indeed follow the opposite method of breaking up all things and refusing to look at them as a whole and in relation to that which justifies them, and so create an intellectual conception of absolute evil, absolute injustice, the absolute hideousness, painfulness, triviality, vulgarity, or vanity of all things. But that is to pursue to its extreme the method of the ignorance, whose view is based upon division. We cannot rightly so deal with the divine workings. This, in a sense, is the divine view of deconstruction. Because the absolute expresses itself through relativities, the secret of which we find it difficult to fathom, because to our limited view, everything appears to be a purposeless play of oppositions and negatives, or a mass of contradictions, we cannot conclude that our first limited view is right, or that all is a vain delusion of the mind and has no reality. Nor can we solve all by an original unreconciled contradiction, which is to explain all the rest. So to say, we cannot reach a profound conclusion from a superficial view. The human reason is wrong in attaching a separate and definitive value to each contradiction by itself, or getting rid of one by altogether denying the other. But it is right in refusing to accept as final and as the last word the coupling of contradictions which have in no way been reconciled together or have not found their source and significance in something beyond their opposition. Something beyond their opposition. This largely concludes his argument versus the law of contradictions. And now he'll proceed to looking at the issue of creation by the eternal. We cannot either effect a reconciliation or explanation of the original contradictions of existence by taking refuge in our concept of time. Time, as we know or conceive it, is only our means of realizing things in succession. It is a condition and cause of conditions, varies on different planes of existence, varies even for beings on one and the same plane. That is to say, it is not an absolute and cannot explain the primary relations of the absolute. So time is linked to the very nature and construction of relationship. We recognize time when we can order events as if on a string. Otherwise, if we don't analyze, we're not aware of the passage of time. They work themselves out, he says, in detail by time. He's talking about the relations. And seem to our mental and vital being to be determined by it. But that seeming does not carry us back to their sources and principles, and those are deeper, beyond the surface. We make the distinction of conditioned and unconditioned, and we imagine that the unconditioned became conditioned, the infinite became finite at some date in time, and may cease to be finite at some other date in time, because it so appears to us in details, particulars, or with regard to this or that system of things. But if we look at existence as a whole, we see that infinite and finite coexist and exist in and by each other. They are not sequential. And here, he'll go into a description of the cosmic cycles. Even if our universe were to disappear and reappear rhythmically in time, as was the old belief, that too would be only a large detail and would not show that at a particular time all condition ceases in the whole range of infinite existence, and all becoming becomes the unconditioned. At another, it again takes on the reality or the appearance of conditions. The first source and the primary relations lie beyond our mental divisions of time, in the divine timelessness, or else in the indivisible or eternal time of which our divisions and successions are only figures in a mental experience. So he speaks of the infinite and the finite being a coherent coexistence, of a universe that arises from, seems to lapse out of expressive becoming, but the origination and the first relations of being within itself are before time. Time is a partnering of process, expressive of relationships as foundational to the universe. So, time is indispensable, but it is indispensable as an expression of eternal being. Time does not create the universe. He continues, there we see that all meats and all principles, all persistent realities of existence, for the finite as a principle of being is as persistent as the infinite, stand in a primary relation to each other in a free, not an exclusive, unity of the absolute, and that the way they present themselves to us in a material or a mental world is only a working out of them in secondary, tertiary, or yet lower relativities. So there is a scaled manifestation with layers and layers of the universe. The absolute has not become the contrary of itself and assumed at a certain date real or unreal relativities of which it was originally incapable. Nor has the one become, by a miracle, the many, nor the unconditioned deviated into the conditioned, nor the unqualitied sprouted out into qualities. These oppositions are only the conveniences of our mental consciousness, our divisions of the indivisible. The things they represent are not fictions, they are realities, but they are not rightly known if they are set in irreconcilable opposition to or separation from each other. For there is no such irreconcilable opposition or separation of them in the all view of the absolute. That is an important point. This is the weakness, not only of our scientific divisions and metaphysical distinctions, but of our exclusive spiritual realizations, which are only exclusive because to arrive at them, we have to start from our limiting and dividing mental consciousness. So we see things ranged in oppositions. We see things as they are or are not. It is this, it is not that. Or it moves sequentially in time. This happens, that follows upon that, and then something else happens, and you can see how they're in a linked order. Therefore, they must have one followed the other. We don't see the true issuance from original being. We don't see the larger context. We have a perspective, but we don't have an all view. And so he carries the philosophic and cosmological insights that we've gathered to this point now into the realm of spiritual practice. We have to make the metaphysical distinctions in order to help our intelligence towards a truth which exceeds it, because it is only so that it can escape from the confusions of our first undistinguishing mental view of things. But if we bind ourselves by them to the end, we make chains of what should only have been first helps. We have to make use, too, of distinct spiritual realizations which may at first seem contrary to each other. Because as mental beings, it is difficult or impossible for us to seize at once largely and completely what is beyond our mentality. But we err if we intellectualize them into soul truths, as when we assert that the impersonal must be the one ultimate realization and the rest creation of Maya, or declare the saguna, the divine in its qualities, to be that, and thrust away the impersonality from our spiritual experience. To pause for a moment, again, his first two great spiritual realizations can be seen here, and could be seen as being mutually contradictory. The first, the realization of Brahmic Nirvana, and the second, the realization of the universal Godhead. Rather than find them contradictory, he brought them into a grand synthesis within his own inner being, which means that they are not opposites. They can each fulfill and support the other. He continues, "We have to see that both these realizations of the great spiritual seekers are equally valid in themselves, equally invalid against each other. They are one and the same reality experienced on two sides, which are both necessary for the full knowledge and experience of each other and of that which they both are. So is it with the one and the many, the finite and the infinite, the transcendent and the cosmic, the individual and the universal. Each is the other as well as itself, and neither can be entirely known without the other and without exceeding their appearance of contrary oppositions." And thus, his view leads to an integrated view, an integral yoga. And now he moves into a summary statement. "We see then that there are three terms of the one existence: transcendent, universal, and individual, and that each of these always contains secretly or overtly the two others. The transcendent possesses itself always and controls the other two as the basis of its own temporal possibilities. That is the divine, the eternal, all-possessing God consciousness, omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, which informs, embraces, governs all existences. The human being is here on earth the highest power of the third term, the individual. For he alone can work out at its critical turning point that movement of self-manifestation which appears to us as the involution and evolution of the divine consciousness between the two terms of the ignorance and the knowledge. The power of the individual to possess in his consciousness by self-knowledge his unity with the transcendent and the universal, with the one being and all beings, and to live in that knowledge and transform his life by it, is that which makes the working out of the divine self-manifestation through the individual possible. And the arrival of the individual, not in one but in all, at the divine life, is the sole conceivable object of the movement." So the individual's power to awake to the transcendent and the universal is that which makes universal fulfillment possible. You are the key. "The existence of the individual is not an error in some self of the absolute which that self afterwards discovers. For it is impossible that the absolute self-awareness or anything that is one with it should be ignorant of its own truth and its own capacities and betrayed by that ignorance either into a false idea of itself, which it has to correct, or an impracticable venture which it has to renounce. Neither is the individual existence a subordinate circumstance in a divine play or lila, a play which consists in a continual revolution through unending cycles of pleasure and suffering without any higher hope in the lila itself or any issue from it except the occasional escape of a few from time to time out of their bondage to this ignorance." So he defies the image of the drop disappearing into the ocean in the first, and he defies the image of a chained insignificance of the individual locked into the machinery of a gigantic cosmos in which the individual has no power to emerge. We might be compelled, he says, to hold that ruthless and disastrous view of God's workings if man had no power of self-transcendence or no power of transforming by self-knowledge the conditions of the play nearer and nearer to the truth of the divine delight. In that power lies the justification of individual existence. The individual and the universal unfolding in themselves the divine light, power, joy of transcendent Satchit Ananda, always manifest above them, always secret behind their surface appearances. This is the hidden intention, the ultimate significance of the divine play, the Leela. So the power of self-knowledge unlocks the conscious force and delight of Satchit Ananda, hidden in universe and self. So our role fulfilled liberates not only in potential but in actuality the cosmos itself and fulfills the divine intent, which is the birth of both universe and individual. But it is in themselves, in their transformation, but also their persistence and perfect relations, not in their self-annihilation, that that must be unfolded. Otherwise, there would be no reason for their ever having existed. The possibility of the divine's unfolding in the individual is the secret of the enigma. His presence there and this intention of self-unfolding are the key to the world of knowledge ignorance. So, if you needed a bracing insight to restore your vision of self, I think you just heard Sri Aurobindo render it. Marvelous. We'll take up the fourth chapter next week and get started on it, our first pass. In consonance with what we just read about the awakened individual, I think tonight we turn to the Book of Beginnings in Savitri. Canto 3, the Yoga of the Soul's Release. As so he grew into his larger self, humanity framed his movements less and less. A greater being saw a greater world. A fearless will for knowledge dared to erase the lines of safety reason draws that bar minds soar, souls dive into the infinite. Even his first steps broke our small earth bounds and loitered in a vaster, freer air. In hands sustained by a transfiguring might, he caught up lightly like a giant's bow, left slumbering in a sealed and secret cave, the powers that sleep unused in man within. He made of miracle a normal act, and turned to a common part of divine works, magnificently natural at this height, efforts that would shatter the strength of mortal hearts, pursued in a royalty of mighty ease, aims too sublime for nature's daily will. The gifts of the Spirit crowding came to him. They were his life's pattern and his privilege. A pure perception lent its lucent joy. Its intimate vision waited not to think. It enveloped all nature in a single glance. It looked into the very self of things. Deceived no more by form, he saw the soul. In beings it knew what lurked to them unknown. It seized the idea in mind, the wish in the heart. It plucked out from gray folds of secrecy the motives which from their own sight men hide. He felt the beating life in other men invade him with their happiness and their grief. their love, their anger, their unspoken hopes entered in currents or in pouring waves into the immobile ocean of his calm. He heard the inspired sound of his own thoughts re-echoed in the vault of other minds. The world's thought streams traveled into his ken. His inner self grew near to others' selves and bore a kinship's weight, a common tie, yet stood untouched, king of itself, alone. A magical accord quickened and attuned to ethereal symphonies, the old earthy strings. It raised the servitors of mind and life to be happy partners in the soul's response. Tissue and nerve were turned to sensitive chords, records of luster and ecstasy. It made the body's means the spirit's acolytes. A heavenlier function with a finer mode lit with its grace man's outward earthliness. The soul's experience of its deeper sheaths no more slept drugged by matter's dominance. In the dead wall closing us from wider self, into a secrecy of apparent sleep, the mystic tract beyond our waking thoughts, a door parted, built in by matter's force, releasing things unseized by earthly sense. A world unseen, unknown by outward mind, appeared in the silent spaces of the soul. He sat in secret chambers looking out into the luminous countries of the unborn, where all things dreamed by the mind are seen and true, and all that the life longs for is drawn close. He saw the perfect in their starry homes, wearing the glory of a deathless form, lain in the arms of the eternal's peace, wrapped in the heartbeats of God ecstasy. He lived in the mystic space where thought is born, and will is nursed by an ethereal power, and fed on the white milk of the eternal strengths till it grows into the likeness of a god. In the witness's occult rooms with mind-built walls, on hidden interiors, lurking passages, open the windows of the inner sight. He owned the house of undivided time. So, Namaste. Jai Ma.